Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Celeste Moore, and you are listening to the Down and Dirty Podcast, aka the Double D's of Dating. This is a podcast for navigating the ins and outs of modern midlife dating. Here, we will discuss the challenges that men and women face in today's dating world. Like many industries, this one is forever changing, and I believe this platform will help those who need or want it. Today, it is the best time to take control of your desired outcome. Whether it is a marriage, significant other, life partner, or just to gain the confidence in dating once again. Every other week, we will dive in and talk about different viewpoints that seem to be challenges in today's dating arena. So let's get into today's episode. Thanks, everybody, again for listening to another episode of the Down and Dirty Podcast. I appreciate all the support from you all listening here, and I get to do what I love. I get to interview these amazing experts in their respected fields, and they get to teach us all about their great topics, and I'm so grateful. So thanks again. Don't forget to give me a 5-star review, rate the show. It would be lovely. It really helps generate more visibility. So anyways, before I jump into today's episode, I would love to introduce my guest today. His name is Dr. Richard Aronson, and he is a dual-trained endocrinologist and geriatrician who lives in Perth, West Australia, with his loving wife of 20 years and their 4 children. He is the head of Department of Geriatric Medicine at Royal Perth Hospital, head of the Murdoch Endocrinology and Diabetes Center, and the chair of Australian Medical Association, Western Australian Public Doctors. He has won numerous prestigious medical and medical leadership awards and lectures widely on endocrinology, medical leadership, and personal management science. He freelances as an MC and stand-up comedian. That is so cool. His favorite hobbies are spending time with his wife and family, playing tennis, keeping fit, and finding creative ways to avoid excessive housework. He is the author of I love this. He is the author of a book, Women Are Superior to Men. Ooh, I can't wait to hear about that. And he has a podcast series called Happy, Healthy, Ever After. That is amazing. You don't really see that bio when you're reading about a doctor and all of his, you know, accolades. And then at the end, let's talk about staying out to avoid excessive housework, writing a book that's very probably controversial in the topic, Women Are Superior to Men. And, you know, that's amazing.
Well, thank you. I must say, I think for everyone, when you hear your own bio, you don't really believe it. You're like, no, that's not me. I didn't do that. Yeah. So thanks.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, we have to praise the things that we've done, and you've done some amazing things and huge hurdles, and I'm sure it's taken quite a lifetime, right? It's a journey.
Absolutely. I think that the amazing thing about life is that you start off at a point and you really don't know what the next 20 years will look like. And then 20 years later, you can look back and go, wow, this isn't where I expected to end up. And that's very true of me personally. I never expected to be where I am. And I've been more surprised than anyone. Yeah. So my greatest critic, my wife, has been the most surprised, I guess.
Well, she's been there with you. So I'm sure, like you said, probably when you both got married, you're like, this is not what I expected. But that makes it fun. That makes it like it just brings something else to life, right? Adventure.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think getting married was probably less surprising than having kids. I was talking to a friend today who's a geriatrician over in Melbourne, and she was saying to me she's about to have a first baby. And I said, wow, you think you know what that's going to be like, but it really is much different to what you expect. So I think getting married was fine, but having kids was a totally new experience and totally, you know, you can't really imagine what that'll be like, I think.
I agree. I've had my own experience. I have one, but did it all by myself. And that's not what I envisioned. And wow, yeah, it's been the most amazing journey, the hardest journey. And, you know, it's still a process. She's only 16. So I don't think you ever stop being a parent. I know they say that, like, oh, they turn 18 and bye. No. It doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think for better or for worse, once you have children, you know, that responsibility and that concern never goes away. I think the kids start to care a little less about what their parents think when they go past a certain age, but certainly the parents never stop caring. And I think that's the beauty and the scary part about it, is that you're just so emotionally invested with them that you couldn't, you know, anything good or bad that happens to them is so amplified in the parent. It's almost like, you know, they always say for coaches watching sport that the player on the court finds it easier. The coach who's watching, who can't quite control it, is actually the more stressed. And I think that's a bit like parenting, really. You stand by and watch your kids often make their own mistakes or things happen to them. And, you know, you are more stressed about it than they are watching from the sidelines.
That's such a great analogy, because it's really pretty on point. I mean, you look at the coach during the game, right? And he's like, you know, he's just like screaming and yelling. And that's, you know, they're just doing their thing, you know, playing the game. Yeah, it's a lot like what our children are going through. So, well, I really appreciate you coming on today's show. I know you are very far away from me in Austin at the moment. You are in Perth, which is, you said, about 11:30 p.m. your time. So thank you for taking the time. Could you just tell everybody a little bit about your journey here? And how is it that you decided to kind of, one, write a book and talk about men and women and their relationships?
Oh, wow. So I'll try and give the briefest version of that story. So when I was ascending through medicine, I found it a very unexpected journey. I got a lot of promotions. Actually, my wife was always saying it was sexist, because she and I were in the same medical class and I kept getting promoted. She's like, oh, it's just because you're male. And she may well have been right, because I'm sure I don't have any natural talent, but it was very surprising to me. And as I sort of ascended into medical leadership, which is a different role in some ways to being a doctor, but also the same role when you're taking care of patients, but you're also taking care of colleagues, what I began to realize more and more was that doctors are often great at medicine, but not always great with people. Because doctors are human like everyone else. Some doctors are good at people and some are bad at people. And you don't get very well trained, I think, at medical school to look after people. And that's something which I've spent my career trying to change. I haven't succeeded with that one yet. So I started to take a great interest in learning more about management of people. And as I became a head of department and a director at a hospital, I was put through a lot of leadership training. And leadership training can be amazing and it can be a waste of time. But I was very lucky and privileged to go on a number of quite exceptional leadership courses. And the more I learned, the more I realized that people are actually all human. I know, wow, how did I get to that? I don't know. People are all human and we respond to things similarly. There's things that we all have in common. We want to be valued. We want affirmation. All these things are the same. And I started to run courses for doctors to try and teach them more about managing people. How do you manage a team? How do you talk to a patient who's stressed? How do you deal with families that are angry or in distress, conflict resolution, all those sorts of human management issues. And I started to teach other doctors that. And my courses became quite popular. And that culminated in my wife coming. Don't worry, this is getting to where I wrote a book. And my wife decided to come on one of the courses. She's a doctor. And she said to me, you know, I really need the professional development points. I'm sure it'll be very boring and I'll learn nothing, but I'm going to come along to watch. So I was very encouraged by that, obviously. And she came along. And then at the end of it, she just went, wow, that was absolutely amazing. I learned so much. You need to write a book because people are so interested in what you have to say. And that was the best moment of my whole life. I never Aww. Knew my wife found me at all interesting or funny. So I was like, wow, this is my best moment ever. So because she commanded me to write a book, how could I disobey? So I started writing about relationships and people. And that I was writing lots and lots and lots about conflict resolution, about relationships, about people, about personnel management science and how to understand that better. And then I was sitting on the ward one night, late at night, doing a late ward round, and the nurses were all getting very upset. And the one was on the phone to her husband and she was saying, you know, why can't my husband work out that you have to feed the children every night? He's had them for 10 years. And then the nurse, next nurse was like, I don't get it. How does he need to be told that he needs to bath the kids? Why do I have to phone my husband during my dinner break? I mean, he doesn't phone me during his lunch break. And then one of them said, oh, you know, having a husband is like having an extra child. And I was sitting there laughing and I just turned to him and I said, hey, you're all just expecting too much. Don't you know that women are superior to men? And they went, wow, that's amazing. You should write a book. And I was like, hey, what a great idea. And I think the one other thing, sorry, I will get to the end of the scene. The one other thing that I always found really fascinating when I got married was hearing all the newlywed couples, because of course you're all at the same age, you all get married. A lot of people get married at the same time, all arguing about the same things. And the men had the same complaints about their wives and vice versa. And I was really fascinated by that because we all think we're so unique and yet we have so much in common. So All of that inspired me to keep writing. And in fact, there's one other weird part to this tale, and that is that I was lucky enough to prolapse a disc in my neck during starting to write my book. And I'll tell you why it was lucky, because I'd been working way too hard. I was doing like really what was the equivalent of 4 jobs at once or more. And I was doing crazy hours and working so hard, and I was forced to take time off. And so it gave me a lot of time to write. So it was really, really helpful. At the end, I was like, I was so lucky to get this injury and end up with no use of my left arm for a few months because I could write with my right arm. So it was fantastic.
It was meant to be. You know, all of the things lined up for you. And unfortunately, but lucky, you had an injury. So, well, you have the perfect title for this book because it really probably intrigues people, right? What does he mean by this? And I love that you created the title, like listening to the nurses complain about their husbands. So I have a question for you, though. What do you mean when you say it's important to promote love and gender in a more positive light? I know it sounds very simple, but I think there's more to it.
Look, it's a huge thing for me. One of my real concerns about the world is that I think as a combination of a multitude of things, and it's a very complex discussion about why we've gone the direction we've gone, particularly in Western democracy, that we seem to hate ourselves so much these days that Western democracy actually has the greatest in the world right now, greatest quality of life, greatest human rights, greatest racial equality, greatest gender equality of anywhere in the world. You'll find that all in Western freedom of speech, free courts. And yet everywhere you go, you just hear people who are so angry and miserable and divided these days and sort of tearing down everything we've built. And I think there's a big difference between saying that we're not perfect and we can keep getting better and there still is inequality in certain things and saying we're terrible and bad. And the same thing seems to have happened with love and gender. We seem to have become so angry and divided, and everything you hear in the press, and there's so much negativity around gender and love. And then you start to have these things coming through. You know, people talk about toxic masculinity, and even masculinity and femininity are now regarded by many people as this negative sort of, you know, gender stereotypes, which, by the way, I very strongly dispute in my podcasts, because I have no. The whole thing about my writing has been very positive. It's been about promoting love and happiness and saying we often are different and that's something beautiful. It attracts us to each other. But promoting the idea that just because some people might be, you know, different sexual interests or they have different gender identification doesn't actually mean that we need to tear down, you know, heterosexual men and women loving each other and finding their differences attractive. So I really wanted to just put positivity back in the space. I spend a lot of the book laughing at myself. So I thought I could at least get away with that. Who can be offended by me laughing at myself? Sort of looking at all the ways that I admire my wife, that she's so much better than I am at certain things, and finding that funny, not offensive. You know, I want to get better and I want to do some of the things that she does. I think one of the dangers of writing a book with this title was actually that I had a few people who hadn't actually read the book. So I think anyone who reads the book won't think that I'm in any way emasculating men or anti-men, because I kind of like being a man and I like women a lot and I like playing sport and being manly, and you know, so there's nothing in the book that is at all emasculating. But I also just wanted to say, hey, isn't falling in love, having children together, the most beautiful thing. Sexuality is something that should bond people and make them happy. And most of all, everyone seems to have lost their sense of humor. So my book's just full of jokes about, particularly about men. And so I find life funny.
I love it. I think we need more of that, right? I mean, you know, you were talking about that, you know, there's such a divide in, you know, I'm not sure what's going on in Australia, but, you know, in the United States, it's just a mess right now. And it has been. And yeah, you need more positivity. You need more love. And I think there's got to be some ways that we can come together. And I think relationships are great, right? Because we're all experiencing some of this in our relationships, whether it's new or long term. And I love that you put some comedy in there, some love sprinkled. You know, it's great. It's exactly what we need. And let me ask, and I was going to wait, but how did you decide, or when did you start doing stand-up comedy?
Well, that's with everything with me. I didn't do it on purpose. It's actually the most ridiculous story. So look, when I was growing up, I always thought I was a bit of a comedian, but what teenage boy doesn't? And at university, I didn't take it very seriously, but if ever they needed someone like a class commentator for something, or, you know, I went on bus tours as a young adult, and I'd be the guy standing up, you know, telling jokes and stuff. And I didn't really think about it. And then later on, of all things, the driest, most boring thing in the world, I started doing lectures on medicine. So I was asked to be a keynote speaker at various conferences and seminars. And I just found that telling jokes and stories and making people laugh was much more fun than being boring and just talking about medicine. So I ended up doing a lot of comedy. And then after a while, it became something that has kind of become known in the, particularly in the, I don't know what you call it, family physicians, general practitioners. So I do a lot, yes, of education for family physicians on my specialties. And they know if they come that it's going to be entertaining and funny. So I ended up doing just more and more and more of that. I'm trying at the moment, I've got a show that I've written called Laughter Isn't the Best Medicine, What Your Doctor Really Thinks About You, which is, you know, I don't think people, if they get told, hey, you know, you've got cancer, but I'm going to make a really good joke about cancer now, I think they would say laughter is not the best medicine. They'd probably rather have some good treatment. But I'm just trying to get that up and running at the moment. It's actually quite hard to get venues in Perth. I don't know what happened in COVID. I mean, did COVID kill off all the venues in Perth? I don't like. Everything, I don't know if you guys have this in the States, but, you know, my favorite coconut drink, I go to the supermarket, there's none of it on the shelves. And I'm like, well, did COVID kill all the coconuts? I mean, what's going on? I mean, there's no people anymore. We didn't have that many people die of COVID, but you can't find doctors, you can't find nurses, you can't find teachers. I don't know what happened during COVID. It's like the secret society took them all away, and I don't know, conspiracy theories. I don't know what happened.
That happened for a while in the States, where people just weren't working because they were collecting money from the government. And they were like, well, why am I working and making more money doing this? Or I can do both and tell them I'm not working. You know, it was like this big thing. But we're pretty much back to normal now. It took a while, though. There was a lack of workers, a lack of, that was a real big problem. So venues, I think we're about back to normal. So I don't know what happened to them over there.
Well, we are very backward. Perth's actually genuinely quite a backward place. So we probably lag behind the United States in everything, you know, by a few years. Okay. The only thing we got going for us is Chris Hemsworth in this country, you know, so everything else.
Is that the part of Australia he lives in? Nice. Yeah. Well,
he lives in Byron Bay, but he's like, yeah, you've got Ryan Reynolds, we've got Chris Hemsworth. So you're probably just ahead of us at the moment.
Well, I appreciate, and I love that that's kind of turned into something for you where you can, you know, make people laugh. I just feel like in the comedian world, and I won't spend too much time here, but nobody can say anything anymore. That's, nothing's politically correct. It's like, you know, the big guys like Chappelle and, you know, I don't know if, you know, Chris Rock, and, you know, they're constantly apologizing in their stand-up. I'm like, how did we get here to where everybody's made fun of, right? To where you can't make fun of anybody without, I don't know. I think it's got to be hard to be in that world.
Yeah, I haven't released all my videos yet, and they gradually will seep onto the internet. But I've been doing a lot of video shorts about this to talk about what tolerance really looks like, and what, you know, that we've become this terribly divided, angry society where everyone feels the need to be offended by everything. And so I totally agree with you. I mean, laughter is not about laughing at people. It's a coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. You know, life is actually scary. If you stop laughing, it becomes a bit scary. You know, people die, bad things happen to people. But laughter is what makes us human. You know, animals don't laugh. We're the only species that laughs. So I keep joking about everything. I must say, my comedy shows generally aren't that politically correct. But I never insult anyone. But I'm not willing to bow to cancel culture and just not make jokes about things. I think it's an awful idea. Like, I'm sorry to say, I'm very anti-cancel culture. I'm very pro people tolerating each other. And tolerating each other means tolerating people with different beliefs, because that's what tolerance is. I don't need to tolerate people with the same belief as me. Where's the tolerance? They agree with me. I have to tolerate my wife because she's always disagreeing with me.
That's a good point. Oh my gosh. Yes, I 100% agree with you. And I think there's just, hopefully we can regain that in the comedy world, because yeah, it's definitely missed. But on the note of getting back to—
Well, I'll tell you something very funny about that. Yeah. I learned recently, Netflix have taken a very, very bold stance on this. And they've gone, we're not going to cancel comedies because they're not politically correct. And they've recognized as well that politically correct comedy just isn't funny, I'm sorry to say.
It's not.
Because if you're not joking about race and religion and sex and gender and stuff like that, what's there left to joke about? Those are the things that are funny. And the jokes that we tell are often at our own expense, or things that make us a bit cringy, but they're not actually to be racist or sexist. They're because they're often laughing at, specifically at attitudes, exposing attitudes for the stupidity. So right. I think that that's, you know, I admire Netflix for doing that. I think it's fantastic.
No, it's great. And I'll just give one little example. It's, I don't know if you've ever watched the Chappelle Show, but I'm sure you have. You know, he does this very, very controversial— I mean, he did a lot, but this particular one where he's lined and he's a member of the KKK. And this, like every person in the Black community was just like, you know, I can't believe he went there. But that's the whole— he could go there, you know, that's his style. But the fact that he can put himself in that situation and just make people just aghast and laugh, you know, it's just— anyways, it's not that you have to go that far, but I'm grateful that Netflix has taken a stance on that. So that's—
well, comedy has to be a bit edgy. I mean, I was very brave a few years ago. I did a show that had a lot of comedy in it from my own local community as a charity fundraiser. So I had to make jokes about people that I knew. And it was very difficult. I mean, at one stage, someone did take great offense to something I said that was so clearly a farce. And farce is supposed to be so stupid that obviously, you know, it's not true. So no one could take it seriously. So no one should be offended by it because it's farce. So that's always the difficulty, is if there's no edge to it, it's not going to be funny. You've got to be a bit edgy to be funny.
Yeah, agreed. Well, I can't wait to— hopefully you can put on your new show. I'm excited for you. So Perth, someone in Perth, open a venue. So I've also been really intrigued. I think you said something— I listened to a few of your podcasts, and you know, you do talk about the concept of— and I think everyone here listening today has heard of the book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And this concept about men and women living on different planets when it comes to relationships, the difference that we have. What are your thoughts on that? Do you believe that there are gender stereotypes?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that I find it quite interesting that the Men Are From Mars book was kind of an iconic book, first book of its kind. And we have moved on a long way from there in society. So if that book had come out now, I think it would have been canceled and made people really angry. Whereas in its time, people found it quite liberating because they went, wow, that is what things are like. Mm-hmm. So I think that that was everything is culturally in its own time, isn't it? So I think the idea, I think from Men Are From Mars, that men come home and they want to retreat to their caves is all very well in a world where men are going to work and their wives aren't, and they're sort of working really hard at the office, and you know, they're that kind of world, maybe that could work. But even then, I talked about this in my book. I've actually got a specific section in a chapter called Why Couples Fight, where I dispute that. And I say that I think it's actually really bad, because if you have a wife who's been home with the kids the whole day, it's very exhausting. I mean, I looked after the children a lot because my wife's a doctor. She did evening shifts, she did night shifts, and I was there looking out. Incidentally, I was always the parent there when they got really bad gastro. I don't know how my wife did it. She's a genius. I mean, she is a brilliant woman as it is, but she always, like, somehow when they had gastro, that was me at home. And I never solved the mommy conundrum of what do you do when your baby starts vomiting, because you're like, one hand, the carpet is covered, and you're like, well, if I try, don't clean it up, it's really bad. It'll be hard to clean up. And what do you do? Dump the vomiting baby in the bath? I never knew what to do. Like, what do you do with the baby? What do you do cleaning up? And so somehow when my wife was there, everything just happened and it was all fine. But like, I had to start calling for her, but she was at work. So it didn't work. So I still never solved that one. So I think that kind of, there's been a big change in the world. Women work very hard. I think for men or women who stay at home, I found looking after kids way harder than going to work. You give me the hardest medical shift with people's heads falling off right, left and center, and, you know, blood everywhere. And give me a baby, and I can tell you the baby is way, way, way harder. In fact, when my wife used to go off to work on a Sunday, and I was like, I spent the whole week like, oh, work is so easy. Sunday is the big day when I really have to be at my best. And she would come home at like 11 at night, and I'd be having my first meal of the day. And she's like, what's wrong with you? Why didn't you eat early? And I was like, I was looking after the baby. And she was like, well, why can't you look after the baby and feed yourself? What's wrong with you? So I think within all of that is probably the answer to your question, because I know it's very unfashionable to say this, but we are biologically designed to survive as human beings. I mean, that's a fact of life. And so women are designed to have babies and to take care of them and to nurture infants. And there's nothing sexist or stereotypical about that. It's literally our blueprint for our survival. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that women can't become presidents or can't choose not to have babies. Men can't stay at home. But fundamentally for survival, humans are designed for women to be mothers. And I think it's the most beautiful thing in the world. I read a few years ago that it said, I'd always thought that a man and woman made the most perfect couple until I saw my wife with our new baby. And I think I talk about this a lot in my book, the sort of relentless breastfeeding cycle and having an infant where you just have to care for them 24/7. It's the hardest thing in the world. I admire women so much for being able to do it. It's not that husbands can't help. It's just how women actually do that is amazing. So I don't think those are necessarily gender stereotypes as much as that's the way we're actually designed. And men have certain skills and women have certain skills. And I say, Luna, if you want something smashed up with a sledgehammer, I'm definitely better than that, than my wife is. That's the truth. I'm bigger and stronger than she is. And, you know, she likes that. And she likes the fact that I can protect her. And that's not a stereotype. It's just a reality. And at the same time, the fact that she's able to do these amazing things. I talk about multitasking in my book that women do. It's not really multitasking, but it's this ability of women to have the sense of in time and space of where everything is at once, you know, the children, when, what time they need to be fetched from school, what's cooking, and do run a Zoom meeting. And husbands, we are designed for focus and we focus on one thing. And that has huge impact on things like sexuality as well, where which, you know, it's not a theory, it's a proven fact that women are often more emotionally connected to the things that they do. And there's much more emotional connection. Men can put sex in a box and it can be just a physical act for them. Women often have far greater problems separating out complex emotions, which is one of the reasons, by the way, that women are superior to men. They have complex emotions. There you have it. So that's a joke, because I think one of the things is men and women are sexual. Both of us are sexual. I'm not talking about you. Nothing personal. I mean, all men and women,
of course.
We are sexual beings. Both men and women are sexual, and men and women have feelings, and there are often quite small margins between us. But at the same time, we are genetically designed for specialized roles that have given us certain, what people might call stereotypical, you know, abilities. But we should celebrate that, because to be honest, you know, I find women the most unbelievably, like, jaw-droppingly gorgeous creatures. Like, that's the way I'm designed so humans can survive. I see a woman, the way women move, the way they stroke their hair, the way that They talk to me. This is the most magical thing in the world. And so I celebrate that. I don't see that as being something negative or nasty. I just think it's beautiful, actually. And if someone's different and if a woman, you know, it doesn't matter. That it's not intolerant of that. It's just we can celebrate what we are without putting down other people who are different.
Yes. Yes, you said it very beautifully. I think that if more men were to look at that through the lenses of your eyes, right, and say, no, this is a beautiful thing. Let's celebrate that versus trying to put these everything in a box. And I find that because that's just the way that you think, right? You compartmentalize each. You focus on one project, you get it done. Another one, get it done. Where we're like, woo, we have 20 things going on at once. It's not always the best thing, but it's just how it's how we think, you know, we're all over the place.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that men are actually better at, evidence-based, is actually reverse parking with a trailer. And the theory about that is exactly that, because women have may not just focus in one part of their brain, according to lots of brain mapping studies, you know, so they tend to be very unifocused. So reversing with a trailer is actually they focused on that one part of the brain, whereas women, because they got so much going on in their minds, apparently somehow or other, it actually makes it more difficult to reverse with a trailer. So it's that's actually something which is true, that on average, men are actually better at reversing with a trailer than women. So we got to hold on to something, because we're not better at very many things, according to my book. So something we're actually good at.
So really quick, I want to go back to, you make a point in your book when you're talking about the old school men are from Mars, women are from Venus. I just want to bring one point up. You know, you talk about how when men are angry or there's been a fight, they go into their cave, right? They want to be left alone. And until they're ready to talk about it, they'll come out. You know, as women, we get it done. We just want to figure it out. We want to talk about it. And we're, you know, like, just, yeah. So my point is, you are saying that this is not healthy anymore. Is that correct?
Well, I think that everyone would agree that it's healthy for couples to communicate and to talk about their problems together. And so I think again, this is something people might call a gender stereotype, but I actually think it's quite a beautiful thing. I think one of the things that women do amazingly well in life is nurturing. And it's not that men can't be nurturing. They should be nurturing. I hope that I'm nurturing towards my kids and my wife, but I think women are fundamentally designed to nurture young children, and they're amazing at it. And I think what women do amazingly well in life is bringing the best out of other people and bringing the best out of their boyfriends and husbands. And you see, if you look at the average 20-year-old guy, I mean, it's a pretty useless thing, isn't it? Bouncing around, drinking beer and making rude jokes. And you look comparatively, I mean, I can see this in my kids' schools, you know, the 18-year-old girls are adults. They're women, and they mature, and their heads are screwed on the right way. The guys are all over the place. They're crazy. But you marry the two off, and suddenly 5 or 10 years later, a wife often has trained her husband and nurtured him to become something so much greater than what he started as. And you have, you know, a great dad and a great husband. And so I think with all of these things, there's with communication, men do have often, they have almost an instinct to retreat when they are confronted with emotion. Not all men, but some men. Mm-hmm. And I think that's hard on wives, because they then presume that that is a relationship issue, that their partner doesn't love them or is actually pulling away from them. But it might be the opposite. It might be that the husband or boyfriend is distressed because he's actually feeling that the relationship's in a difficult place. So I think that how you get a husband or boyfriend out of that box is important. And sometimes it's important to give someone a little bit of space. But I think coaxing conversation is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And you can't solve problems by a husband sitting grumpily in the corner, you know, going fishing and watching a ball game. That's not going to solve relationship problems.
Right.
Especially if his team loses, then he'll just be in a bad mood for an extra week.
So do you talk about different forms of communication? Or it's just understanding your partner and finding the ways that you guys best communicate? How do you say it's a young couple, right? And they're just learning how to communicate. What are your thoughts on learning styles, I guess, even?
Well, I guess a very unfashionable style that we all unaccustomed to in the modern day is listening. And if you go on any leadership course, everyone talks about it, but it's actually so important because the number one factor in people being satisfied in relationships is that they feel valued. And the only way people feel valued is if their opinions, they feel their opinions are listened to, heard, and taken seriously. So I think the one thing that you'd want to teach anyone in the world is to listen better. I think humans have such a, you know, desire to talk all the time and push their opinions across. So I think the first thing is teaching people to listen to each other and truly listen and understand what the other person is saying. And even if you just achieved that, I think you've achieved a lot in a relationship. And there's obviously a lot more to that, you know, learning to respect each other, be considerate, taking care of someone's feelings, and verbal and nonverbal communication. So I think, for example, that, you know, men are very tactile at the best of times. And I think women are very good at coaxing conversations out of them by being a bit more tactile often. I think that is actually a reasonable strategy as well. It's so easy when people to get angry with each other to pull away physically. But actually, what you want to do is pull together physically, because the last thing that's going to heal your relationship is if you're angry with each other and you stop intimacy, affection. That's the time where you really need to hold each other and say, hey, we love each other. We're having a fight, but we don't want to be distant. So I think there's any number of ways that couples come together and communicate. We could probably talk about it all night, but I think that's the major thing.
Yeah, those are some great points. It's something that I really focus on teaching my clients on first dates. Listen 80% of the time and speak 20%. Trust me, it will be huge. And her being heard is huge. Yeah. And I'm not saying that you don't deserve to be heard as well, but you know, this is just in the first date or two. So listening is huge. And like you said, it's not just being quiet, but actively listening, actually remembering what they said and hearing it. So yeah. Well, thank you for that.
And if you're a man, she's going to test you at some point. So you better be listening.
Exactly.
There's a test at the end.
Don't you remember? Weren't you listening?
Well, that's a good test, isn't it? Because and my wife does that to me all the time. She knows that I'm distracted often. So what she does is, you know, she asks me a few yes, no questions. And then suddenly she asks me an either or question. And then I go, yes. And she's like, I knew you weren't listening. So that's something she was trained at wife school, I think, to find out husbands. We all get caught up by that one. And we all like, oh, I can text and talk to you at the same time. It's like, no, you can't.
Not when it's important, right? So,
well, I think that's a good tip for first dates as well.
Yeah.
Turn off your phone, put it away.
Oh, for sure.
You know, that's something which is so terrible nowadays, that so many people sit talking, you know, even when you see families together and everyone's on their phones instead of talking and being close, and you see people going on dates and they're on their phones. You're like, no, look at each other in the eyes and talk to each other. It's much better.
It's so crazy, because every time that I'm out at a restaurant and I see a couple, they're sitting at the table facing each other on their phones. I'm like, this is either not going to last, or this is just going to be a disaster. So yeah, even I've gotten on my daughter, who's like, loves to, you know, have dinner with me, but not really. She's like, shh, you know, and I'm like, can you just put it down? Really? Can we just have like, I'm only asking 5 minutes.
It's such a worrying, I must say, to me, it's actually a very worrying culture, because we don't always appreciate what addictions do to people for a long time. So historically in medicine, we didn't really appreciate what alcohol or smoking did to the human body and how much it affected society, psychology, mental, physical health, till many, many years after, you know, after addiction started to come through. And I think this very profound mental and physical effects of people being on their phones permanently. And as you've correctly stated, it's just not the same as a relationship. You know, Siri might be able to put on any accent, but she's not really your friend. Or he, I don't know, some people have. So it's a sad thing. So my wife's very good at this. She is very religious about the fact that every Sunday we have to go out on a walk together as a family. And when we go out, I hand her my phone, turn it off and hand it to her, and she puts it in her bag and that's it. And I think that's great. I think it's a very good idea. Because if I had it in my pocket, the truth is work texts me and calls me and nurses are calling from the ward. Mm-hmm. And I'm not on call. I'm allowed to, you know, not answer all of that immediately. So she just takes the phone away, puts it in a bag. And I think I'm very grateful for that. I know I voluntarily hand over my phone now. I used to run and defend myself with sticks, but now I just give it to them. I lost every time. There was no point.
Yeah, so you might as well just give it up. Well, I hear that even just shutting down from literally everything, going outside on a walk is so healing and rejuvenating, and it allows us to get through the work week. There's something about, one, being in nature, but two, like just completely shut off and just taking a walk and just being outside. So I think that's amazing.
They always used to say fresh air is good for people, but actually, interestingly, in medical burnout, so I've done a bit of work with doctors with medical burnout. And one of the most important things that you have to do for medical burnout is create spiritual space effectively away from your career. Mm-hmm. So doctors just need to turn off their phone, get away from work, and do something where their mind is not connected. They can't be contacted. That space is completely sacrosanct away from work. So there's actually, it's an evidence-based way of healing the mind to actually have this space. And it doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's completely unconnected with work and you're relaxed and you're in a different zone completely. But I think the same goes for families as well. It's terrible nowadays. There's so many families that I know they did a study in the UK a few years ago that 80% of families in the UK don't have dinner together at all. They all just come in with their phones and help themselves to some food, and they don't ever have family dinners. And there's good evidence that families that eat together actually have much closer, better relationships, and better, also the kids have better psychological long-term outcomes from that. And that makes sense, because obviously family life is so important for emotional and psychological well-being. So I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's so important.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I grew up. My parents, someone would call the house. I mean, we had landlines then. There was no cell phones. But if somebody interrupted, we couldn't answer it. It was like, no, we're eating dinner. We're going to talk about our day.
Yes. Yes. Those were the days. I bet you're not as old as me, because I lived through a time where we used to actually dial on the phone.
I remember those as well. Okay. I was a child when those came. The rotary phones.
And you know what's so funny? If you had teenage kids, it was like a queue, because you had like one line. And
yeah.
You know, it's always like you used to take turns to call your boyfriend or girlfriend. And it's like, my sister's been on the phone too long. It's been 20 minutes. I want to call my girlfriend. And no one could get through. And everyone the next day was like, my parents would be like, Joan was trying to call us the whole night last night and couldn't get through. What's going on? It's like, well, it was like every other night. We were all sitting on the phone.
Exactly.
Those are the good old days.
Yeah. And then call waiting happened. And that was like, someone could get through when you were on the phone. So that was, you know, yeah, great times. But yeah, it's very disturbing for my child to know that, like, it is such an addiction. And I really have to just say, you've got to put it down for this. I know that this is school, this is social. I mean, it's so many things, right? But yeah, detaching from the phone. And like you said, it doesn't, having that week of a couple hours that away from work, away from whatever it is, to rejuvenate and to kind of like get centered again is so huge.
I think that's also fascinating with kids though, isn't it? I know this is a bit far off the topic of women and men, but as it happens, I've actually just written a book on parenting, believe it or not. So I'm very excited about this topic as well. It'll be a long time before, I don't know, the editing and the publishing process is very long, but these are all the kinds of things to talk about. But I find it a bit of an irony that at school nowadays, that we're so worried about kids being on phones and, you know, iPads all the time. And what has the schools done? They've just put every single kid on an iPad permanently. They go to school. It's like, oh, you need training to, you know, this is the modern world. But it actually isn't the modern world. You could just as well do high level training as, you know, touch typing and learning to use all these brilliant programming things and digital this and that. But you can still have a lot of time at school where kids are actually not on a device. So I think we've actually perpetuated this even further and made it worse. And we've all just accepted that that's the way it has to be, but it doesn't. It would be so much better for those kids to be interacting with teachers personally, interacting with each other in the class, and mm-hmm. actually not have so much screen time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think there's got to be a balance, but it's the easy way and it's the modern way, like you said. So I don't know. Well, you'll have to revisit that. I'll have to wait to read your book to hear more about that. I have a question. Why do you think and why do you believe that there's most common reasons why couples fight?
Well, there's actually, there's serious reasons and there's funny reasons.
Okay.
So I think the serious reasons that everyone talks about is sex, money, and kids are sort of the reasons why people, you know, have major fights. Mm-hmm. And I think sex is a big reason why couples fight, because the movies, I think, teach people that sex is always going to be fun and people screeching in delight permanently. And, you know, there's, it makes it all look so easy. And people have these incredibly high expectations of their sex lives. We even now see that, by the way, there's a lot of sexual dysfunction in young adults who have this incredibly high expectation of sex, and they find it actually very difficult to deal with the real life issue, which is that sex, like everything in life, requires hard work. You've got to invest in your relationship. You've got to work together. There's times when things may not work as well as you hoped they'd work. You know, there's going to be days when someone's a bit off. Obviously, never me, but other people. So, you know, it's not so easy. And I think this idea that couples will have matched libidos and always be enthusiastic. I mean, people have ups and downs in their libido, and, you know, there's all kinds of challenges around sleep deprivation and work stress, and having kids particularly, I think, is a huge challenge. So I think those things couples fight a lot about. And I think kids bring about a lot of conflict because they create such a difficult dynamic in relationships, because especially for couples that haven't really thought about their values together, they haven't talked about values enough when they were dating, they get married and they might have very different ideas about how to bring up kids. And that is a massive problem, because you have to be united as a team with parents, because kids are tough. They are, you know, tough little creatures. They're going to try and push boundaries and they're going to push your relationship. And I see a lot of parents also being really manipulated by their children to, you know, really bad outcomes. So I'll tell you a horrible story about this. This is a horrible one. You just have to sort of steel yourself. So okay. This is a cringy one. So we were having lunch with, this is about kids manipulating their parents. So we're having lunch with this couple, and their daughter is not that young. She was, you know, 6 or 7, at least, maybe at least that. So we're sitting out having a civilized lunch, and she goes, you know, I sleep in mommy and daddy's bed every night. And then she starts imitating some sounds that her mom was making. And she goes, and then the dad's like, yeah, mommy has a really sore back. And the kid was like, oh, well, I think if mommy's back so sore, maybe dad shouldn't sleep in the bed for a while to give her a bit more space so that she can recover. And I was like, that's an awesome idea. I don't think dad should be sleeping in that bed either. And maybe that 6-year-old girl shouldn't be sleeping in that bed. So that was like really like everyone like just glossed over it. It was like, fine, she's mom's got back pain. Sure. Yeah. Those sounds didn't sound like any. I'm a doctor. I've heard a lot of back pain. Never sounded like that. So, you know, I think that that's a, so children are a big reason why couples fight. But actually, there was a study recently in Australia that said the biggest reason for divorce is actually inattention, which I found really interesting. So 80% of couples who got divorced cited inattention as a reason that they got divorced. And that really makes a lot of sense, because whether it's sex or kids or whatever it is, when people stop giving each other attention, that's when relationships really break down. You've got to keep nourishing and feeding your relationship, yes, your intimacy, your life together.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we all need to be validated, heard, desired, all of those things. And if you're not attending to your partner in any, yeah, I can see where, oh, well, I guess I'll get it from this person. You know, I mean, I feel that I always say it's so healthy to have, like, you know, you have a healthy diet, you have exercise, you know, sex, it's such an important part in a relationship and being an adult, right? Being satisfied, being heard, being intimate with someone. There's so many things within that role or that part. And yeah, if that's not being met, just like if I'm not getting fed or I'm not getting water to drink, I'm going to look for it somewhere else.
Well, I think that that's one of the worst things ever. Again, I was sitting having lunch with a couple, and the husband and wife were chatting, and then the husband goes, oh, well, my wife really doesn't like being touched. And I was like, whoa, I lost like a dagger in my heart. I was like, that's the worst. Like, that's a nightmare. So I think you're absolutely right when you use the word intimacy, because I think the mistake that people make about sex is that sex isn't just about the act of sex. It's about intimacy. And there's so much more to intimacy than just the sexual act. It's about two people sharing pleasure, sharing closeness, sharing love. And out of that comes often very meaningful conversations, very meaningful moments. You know, it's the language of touch is we're mammals, we're warm-blooded, we want to touch each other, we want to be close to each other. So, you know, it's not just about the sexual act itself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, absolutely. And when people stop making time for intimacy, that's a real statement about their relationship in many ways. You've got to make time and you've got to put effort into keeping a relationship alive. And that means putting aside time for everything that's important. So I've told the story many times, but I think the worst version of this was a story in my book I call The Lock on the Door. So this is 100% true story. There's nothing about this that isn't true. So I saw a couple, the husband came to see me because he thought he had low testosterone. And I asked him, so that he was 42. I said, well, how often do the two of you have sex? He said, never. And his wife looked at me like really angrily. She was like, hey, we've got four children. Like, what do you expect? And I was like, okay, well, some people with four children still do have sex. And they looked at me like I was crazy. And they were like, what? You think our friends do stuff like that? I was like, probably, yes. Some of them at least, I think, probably. So they were like really angry with me. And they were quite aggressive about this idea that people could still have sex after having children. And then quite funnily, he said to me, well, when you're 42 and have four children, you'll understand. And amazingly, I actually was 42 and have four children. So I was like, I was laughing to myself, like, you just don't realize I am 42 and four children. I do understand. So I was chatting to him and I said, well, I mean, what's the problem? Is it that you don't desire sex? And he was like, oh, well, you know, the children, oh, you know, what would we do about them? They could walk in. Now, I know that you didn't go to medical school, probably, Celeste. So this will astound you, the genius of this. And I was like, well, have you two ever heard of a lock on the door? And they were like, whoa, revolutionary, genius. So I said, why don't you put a lock on the door? And they were still not satisfied. And the wife says to me, but won't the children know what we're doing if we lock the door? And I was like, that's okay. All children realize at some age, they reach the point where they realize by their existence that their parents must have done that at some stage. And they've got to come to terms with that. And humans are quite well designed to come to terms with that. It's natural. It's normal. We all know that. That's what our parents did. It's yucky, but we're all okay. I don't think anyone's come to psychological harm from the realization that their parents must have cohabited for them to be born. So then they came back to see me for follow-up. His testosterone levels were quite normal. They came back to see me, and then I had to hear all the, you know, I'm a doctor, you know, I'm actually not a sex therapist. I had to hear all the lurid tales about exactly what they were doing. So I put a lock on the door so they wouldn't come back. So, you know, but they went away very happy.
You're like, I'm not a therapist. I only examine you and see how high and low your testosterone is. Oh, that's amazing.
Well, I have to tell you, even with that, I mean, I do have to feel men's testicles sometimes. There's no question about that. And I, you know, it's not actually my favorite part of the job. So one day I was examining this guy and he was horrified. I said to him, well, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to examine your testicles. And he was like, really? So he pulls his pants down. He's pulling all these faces. Now think about my position. I'm down there, you know. So I look at him. I was like, dude, you can close your eyes. Whose position would you rather be in right now? So he just packed up laughing. He's like, hey, you're right. Much worse for you. And I was like, exactly. Much worse.
Put yourself in my shoes. That's amazing. I know we all do things in I've heard. I have a lot of family physicians in my family and, you know, stories on stories. So, yes. Thank you for doing what you do.
It's a very weird profession. It's a very weird profession, medicine. I think that's why I want to do my comedy show, Laughter isn't the best medicine, because I think it's such an odd career where people just walk into the room and they've never met you before. And next thing they're talking about their marital problems, their sex life, weird stuff that happened to them as a child, anything. And, you know, taking off their clothes. I mean, I've had a few bad experiences where patients have taken off their clothes when I really didn't want them to. I think the worst of that was I had a woman came to see me and I just wanted to look in her mouth, but I used the wrong words. I said to her, okay, I just need to examine you. And then I reached down to get like a torch and a tongue depressor. And when I looked up, she was naked. I was like, what? What? You know? And I don't think that happens to men in other careers, as far as I know, that they just like see a woman as a client. Next thing, they're naked.
They're naked. Yeah.
I didn't ask for this.
I don't imagine so. I think that's very unique within your industry. Well, I can't wait to like read everything in depth in your book because it sounds amazing. And I can't wait to read your other book when it comes out because I think we all are, most of us are parents here. So it sounds fascinating. I want to ask you a question. This is not related to your expertise, but it's just related to your life. What is one of your favorite dates and what was it?
Well, actually, my wife and I have a very strange relationship to start with. So you're asking for a long story because actually it was a very special date. So my wife and I were in the same medical class. My wife's amazing. She's a medical inventor and a doctor, and she has like 5 jobs, and she's a really extraordinary person. She even does plumbing and electrics. I don't know, you know, it's real. She's
phenomenal.
Just does everything. So my kids call her the mama papa because she's like both parents rolled into one. They like, and she always, whenever they come to her, she shouts, two parents to remind them, like, you do have another parent, you know, you can go to them for some help for a change. So we were in the same medical class, and it was really weird because I used to, you can imagine, chat a lot in lectures and make jokes all the time. And that was my thing. I wasn't really very interested in medicine and didn't learn much. So I was friendly with all my wife's female friends, and they all thought I was funny. And when I used to come and sit in lectures, she used to move away to go to another row. She thought I didn't notice, and I did. And she was like, and I later on, I said, well, you know, of course I noticed. Just like, but it was irritating. You were always making jokes during lectures, and I was trying to actually learn medicine. So I was like, boring, you know. So the only thing that she never explained was she came and gave me a bouquet of roses on my birthday in the middle of a lecture theater in front of 200 medical students. And she's never explained that. She just went, well, that's what you do. And I was like, no, it really isn't. Like, no girl's ever given me a bouquet of roses before in front of 200 people on my birthday, but thanks. It was nice. So I think my wife was very clever. She decided that she, because she's the smart one in the relationship, that she did actually want to date me, I think, secretly. So she knows that I play tennis. So she said to me, what are you doing today? Now, any single man, a pretty woman, rings him up and says, what are you doing now? And they've got nothing to do. They're like, well, you know, open to any offers. So she said, well, let's go and play tennis. So we ended up playing tennis, and then we ended up going out for lunch, and then we ended up going out to sit on a beach, and then we ended up going out for dinner. So it was really this sort of massive day-long date and really quite amazing. So that was kind of the start of things. And when we got back to, that was during the vacation of our medical school year. When we came back to class, then we were like inseparable from then on. And we've kind of spent very few nights apart since then.
That's beautiful.
So I think because I get sort of scared and lonely, she's fine.
She's there to protect you or just snuggle with you. Oh, that's beautiful.
No, I don't know. My wife's not one of those. My wife is like, you stay on your side of the bed, you know, during the night. I need my sleep, you know.
Sleep is important. Right.
Yes. I'm a very sappy husband. I would gladly sleep, you know, entwined with my wife every night. And she's like, no, I need my space. You know, it's
well, hot a few
and
minutes.
Bombs of goat. Yes,
a few
exactly.
minutes before bed, right? Well, where can people purchase your book, listen to your podcast, anything that you'd like to share for the audience listening?
Yeah, look, what I would like to share is something nice, and that is that I think it's so easy to despair in a world that's so full of negativity. And yet there's nothing more beautiful than falling in love, having a baby together, you know, growing old together. All my happiest patients are, you know, an old couple who've been together for 50 years. It's, you know, it's something quite beautiful when you see it. So don't lose hope and don't be brought down by a world that's become so negative and divisive. And the best way for people to come together is to form relationships. Not just sexual relationships, but general relationships, making friends, bonding with people, talking to people. Wonderful talking to you tonight. You know, it's been amazing for me. So thank you. So I think that's make the connections, talk to people, smile more and be happy. And don't let this world get you down because it's actually, we live in amazing times. So where can people get hold of me? My website is drrickyaronson.com. My podcasts are very widely available. They're on Apple, they're on Spotify. They're on a whole lot of other platforms, which I'm embarrassed that I should know and I don't.
Okay.
And my book's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble in the States, but Amazon's probably the easiest place to go. So thank you.
Well, I hope everybody goes and gives it a read, because I think it's, like I said, I love the spin on love and comedy, because we all need it, you know. So thank you again for coming on the show. And I look forward to everything in the future with your next book, too.
Well, thank you. It's been, as always, a real pleasure and lovely talking to you. Real privilege.
Same. Thank you so much. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. Come and hang out with me on Instagram at CelesteMoreImage. Let me know your thoughts on today's episode, because I always love hearing from you all. You can find all the links and resources in the show notes of the episode on my website, CelesteMoore.com. Okay, that's all for now. I'll see you in the next episode. See you next time, friends.